Hello and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at National Public Radio. I'm Christopher Joyce, and with me is...
Alison Richards, and I'm an editor, not a reporter.
Good to have you with us again. Welcome to the podcast. Today we're going to hear something about the nation's grid problems and where Washington thinks the solution lies.
And we have Joe Palca, who talks to a scientist about the role our genes might play in who gets sick and who doesn't. But we're starting with something a little bit more philosophical.
We're lucky to have John Hamilton in the studio with us today. John's a correspondent on the Science Desk, and he specializes in studies about the brain, one of the things he specializes in. And today he's going to talk and tell us a story about God and the brain. Alison, you were the editor. Tell us a bit about this, and maybe you guys can fill me in on what it's all about.
Well, yes, it's my pleasure and delight to edit Mr. Hamilton. And it's only 3 weeks or so before you did your last story on God and the brain, when you talked about Darwin and evolution and fights over how the brain evolved. And then this week you found a piece in a journal and came to me saying, yes, please, I want to do this. What is it with you and God and the brain?
Well, this piece sort of picked up where the last one left off. I mean, the argument the last time was more about consciousness and whether human consciousness had been put there by God or some other supernatural being. So when I saw this study looking at how our brain responds to supernatural beings, I was sort of curious.
Now, John, I know from editing these pieces with you that we have to tread very carefully in this kind of area. I mean, when you set out to do these stories, what are all the things in your mind about having to be careful?
Well, I try to be careful about several things. One of the things I try to be really careful about is using terminology in the correct way. So if you're talking about belief, make sure that you really are talking about belief, not fact. And if you're talking about scientific fact, make sure you're talking about that and not belief. And of course, in stories like this, because people have a lot of emotional investment in these types of things, you want to be really careful to make sure that if there are two sides in such a story, you give each side absolutely the best possible opportunity to make its case. And I try to do that.
Now, on the web comments went big time on both these stories. I mean, it does seem to be something that listeners get pretty fired up about.
Yeah, I mean, for obvious reasons, there have been debates for a long time about both Darwin and God, and about the nature of consciousness, and about God's place in the brain. I mean, the two schools of thought you find in both of them is one school assumes that God is responsible for placing things like human consciousness, and that only a supernatural being like God could have done that. The other assumes that those types of things evolved.
Okay, well, what did this study try and show?
Well, this study was looking at people's brains as they talked about religious belief. And what it looked at was what parts of the brain were reacting when people talked about God. It was not so important whether they described themselves as believing in God, but regardless of that, what part of their brains lit up?
Okay, let's hear the story then, John.
Here we go. A team from the National Institutes of Health wanted to know what goes on in people's brains when they encounter statements like this.
I believe God is with me throughout the day and watches over me.
Or statements like this.
God is angry at human behavior.
Jordan Grafman runs the cognitive neuroscience section at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. He was part of a team that studied the brains of 40 people, some religious, some not, using a technology called functional MRI. Grafman says some people agreed with the statements about God's love or anger, while others didn't. But either way, the statements got a response in areas of the brain involved in empathy and understanding what other people might be thinking.
If the statement was that God has a presence in my daily life. Well, that's making an inference, first of all, about God as a being of some kind, as an essence of some kind. So you're making an inference about an entity and their relationship with you. That would activate areas, for example, in the left frontal cortex of the brain, all such areas activated as well if you were making an inference about a friend's intentions.
Grafman says there were differences between religious and non-religious people. Those who said they believed in God had a negative emotional response to statements like, there is no higher purpose. Non-believers had the same reaction to statements that assumed God exists. Grapman says the results show that, to the brain, religious belief is a lot like political belief.
If you're very conservative and you have to make a judgment about what looks like a liberal statement and you disagree with that, you might find this very same brain systems being activated.
Grapman says the new study says nothing about whether God exists, but it does suggest that belief in a supernatural being depends on brain systems that evolved quite recently.
We believe that some of the same underlying abilities that support other sorts of complex human social behavior also support the behavior that we're terming religious belief.
Grapman says that probably means religions appeared as humans evolved the ability to handle really complicated social interactions. Joseph Babulia is an expert on the cognitive psychology of religion at Victoria University in New Zealand. He says religious belief has helped societies survive and thrive for thousands of years. Without religion, he says,
so much of what is possible for us, large-scale cooperation, which now spans the world, would be impossible.
Babulia says religious belief means people share the same set of rules about behavior and think they'll be punished if they don't follow them. It also unites people, especially in times of great uncertainty. Babulia says it's no accident that President Obama invoked religion during his inaugural address.
And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
Babulia says much of that speech was about how people have survived hard times in the past by working together.
We've got through it by being committed to each other. And we'll do it again, but only by being committed to each other through these old values.
Which means using the areas of the brain involved in empathy and understanding. The research appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Oh, that was great. And also raises lots of questions, of course. I don't suppose that the scientists expect that this will resolve questions of how the brain actually perceives God. But one of the things that occurred to me that they mentioned is this notion that you have to have a certain level of complexity in the brain before you're able to really get a notion of this idea of a creator. Is that what they're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, it may sound like you're somehow lowering the interaction with God when you talk about treating God like another person, but in fact, that's an extremely complicated thing that goes on in our brain. We have things called theory of mind and these parts of the brains that are very, very good at figuring out what other people are thinking. They're also involved in things like empathy, but there are a way of looking at what's going on in the mind of another person.
And so this is a sort of a notion of the other, that the other has a brain. It's something a chimp or a bonobo couldn't do.
Yeah, both chimps and bonobos have what many people term a sort of rudimentary theory of other mind. They have some sense of what others are thinking. In fact, sometimes they will look to see whether somebody is watching as they hide something and that type of thing. And they will to a certain extent try to predict the actions of another by looking at them and trying to figure out what they're thinking. But it's the thing that if you look at some of the differences both in the brain and the behavior of great apes and humans, it's one of the things that most distinguishes us. We have a much, much more sophisticated theory of other minds.
Okay, well, thanks very much, John. Now we're going to take a sort of a wild swerve here to something new and different from brains and God. John happens to be also something of an expert on plastics.
Well, I have a number of stories coming up that are going to be about plastics. Having dispensed with God and the brain, I'm going to move on to plastics, which is, it may seem like an odd transition, but it's another part of what I cover here. And for the past really 30 years, there's been a lot of debate about stuff coming out of plastics that acts like sex hormones in our body. And you often hear people refer to phthalates and bisphenol, things coming out of plastic products. And so I'm going to be doing a number of stories trying to get into the science and what people believe about plastics and what we know and what we don't know.
Hey, Allison, you're going to be in charge of that. So what are you going to have John do?
Well, I think we're going to try and get right back down to the basics of what the scientists know, don't know, and even at this present stage of research can know, and also try and fathom out why such strange things are happening that government advisors and agencies are saying, no, we don't need to ban some of this stuff, and yet Congress is going ahead and banning them. So there's a lot to be going on with here. And of course, we want them all done by next. I want them all done by next week.
Not a problem.
Thanks a lot, John. Glad to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
Most scientific advances move forward in tiny little increments. But every so often, someone comes up with a really big idea that starts to get traction. And that started to happen in the world of infectious diseases. Joe Pelker did a story this week about the role our genes might play when a microbe heads our way.
It is so well known today that germs cause illness that it's hard to imagine a time when that wasn't known at all. But Jean-Laurent Casanova says in the 19th century there were different ideas about why some people developed high fevers and died. Casanova heads the Laboratory of Human Genetics of Infectious Diseases at the Rockefeller University in New York City.
Before infectious diseases were thought to be infectious, there was an opposing theory that proposed that these diseases actually reflected a specific weakness of specific families or populations.
In other words, people got sick because of something they inherited. But then Louis Pasteur came along and proved that microbes cause disease, and people forgot about the notion that fevers seem to run in families.
People who were sick because they were infected by a microbe, the microbe causing tuberculosis or leprosy or pneumococcal disease, you know, whatever, that infection equals disease.
The discovery of penicillin, the first potent antibiotic, seemed to prove this. Destroy the bacteria causing the infectious disease, and you cure the patient. But Casanova says the story isn't as simple as that. Beginning in the early 20th century, scientists began to notice that some people could get infected with a disease-causing microbe and not get sick. Take the case of pneumococcus bacteria. Casanova says nearly every child is infected at some point with this bacterium. Most get nothing worse than sniffles or an earache, but a few wind up in the hospital intensive care unit with severe pneumonia. Why?
We know that the microbe is necessary, but we ignore for most patients and for most infectious diseases what are the other factors that account for some people developing clinical disease when others do well, do not present any symptom.
Casanova has now found genes that may explain the difference. These are genes that make children acutely susceptible to one and only one infectious disease, in this case, pneumococcus infections. He has also found candidate genes that make children susceptible to other microbes, including the herpes simplex virus type 1. Normally, this virus causes nothing worse than a cold sore, but in rare cases, it can cause a devastating brain disease called herpes simplex encephalitis. Casanova admits there hasn't been a lot of progress in unraveling the relationship between specific genes and specific diseases, but he says there's a historical reason for that.
There are thousands of laboratories in microbiology searching for novel microbes, searching for the mechanisms of microbial pathogenesis, but there are only a handful number of laboratories investigating the human genetics of infectious diseases.
Immunologist Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, believes Casanova is onto something important.
Because as someone who sees patients and has seen patients with serious infectious diseases, I have seen individuals who are otherwise strappingly healthy in their 20s who come in with overwhelming herpes simplex encephalitis.
Fauci says in the absence of any other obvious explanation, someone's genetic background may hold the key. And knowing the genetics could suggest drugs in addition to antivirals or antibiotics that could help individual patients.
Whenever you have a disease that's caused by a microbe, there are two parties involved. There's the microbe and there's the host. So you want to learn as much as you can about the microbe, but you also want to learn as much as you can about the host.
Fauci says Casanova's work is an important reminder that in the case of infectious diseases, it takes two to tango. Joe Palka, NPR News.
We've also had plenty of news this week. Now, I'm off the energy beat now that I'm not editing you, Chris, but I keep hearing the word grid, smart grid.
Dumb grid, half smart grid.
Dumb grid. The grid is the answer to everything. Gridlock. What's going on? What's this all about?
Well, first of all, let me tell you a little bit of what the grid is. It's the simple way of talking about all those transmission lines that carry electricity from the power plants. It's transformers, it's substations, it's that whole network, that nebulous network that carries electricity that ends up coming out of the socket in your wall. Right now, Washington is obsessed with it because there's a tremendous amount of money in the stimulus package to make the grid so-called smart, make it more efficient, make it work better, and also to change it so that you can get alternative energy wheeled into the grid, because most of those resources, the wind and the big places where the sun is the brightest and the most intense, don't happen to be where people are who need it. So you have to spend, well, I think it's $14 billion in the stimulus package that's being spent or will be spent on this.
In terms of how you and other people at NPR are going to try and cover this, what's in the works?
Well, we're going to be spending a lot of time covering energy in the grid. Richard Harris is with us. He's going to be doing a lot of that. And, in fact, Richard has this week been covering something that is related to energy, certainly a story that's been with us for decades now that may be coming to sort of an end, which is the story of Yucca Mountain. Richard, tell us about Yucca Mountain.
Well, this is not a story that's coming to an end. Actually, what's interesting about this is it's a story that they've declared doesn't have to come to an end within our lifetimes, and that's how the nuclear power industry hopes it can continue to move forward. And this is the story about what to do with all the nuclear waste that the nation's power plants generate. And the early and easy answer seemed to be dig a hole in Nevada and put it in a hole. But that story turned out not to be nearly that simple.
Was it a problem, basically, of the science not doing the job of making it clear that it's safe or unsafe, or was it more perhaps a political denouement?
It was clearly the politics trumping the science. The science really is still being done on Yucca Mountain. They're still evaluating it as a suitable place to put nuclear waste. And the decision to put it there predated by, as it turns out, decades, the actual research to determine whether it's actually a safe place for it to go. They've already spent $8 billion digging a hole in this rock formation out in the middle of nowhere in Nevada. But it's possible that it will just be a monument to government sort of trying to force its way into a situation and ultimately not succeeding.
$8 billion spent.
So far.
Is that more than the superconducting supercollider that we spent how much on?
It tops the superconducting supercollider, which is now, I think, the
another hole in the ground.
A huge hole in the ground in Texas that I think they decided ultimately to turn into a mushroom farm, underground mushroom farm.
Well, perhaps Yucca Mountain has a future. Well, let's hear the story about Yucca Mountain that you wrote for our, what was it, Morning Edition or All Things Considered?
It was on Morning Edition this week.
Let's hear it.
The story of Yucca Mountain is actually a saga that has stretched out over three decades, and one of the key players is Senator Harry Reid of Nevada. Sometimes he sounds like a guy who believes the federal government should take precedence over states, like this comment last month about siting electric power lines.
We're going to move beyond one state being able to hold up forever something that needs to be done for the rest of the country.
Those words earned Reid a few quiet guffaws, considering they come from a man who has argued that Nevada has the right to kill the nation's nuclear waste plans. To be sure, Nevada got a raw deal back in the early 1980s when Congress chose Yucca Mountain as the nation's nuclear waste repository. Robert Fry from the think tank Resources for the Future says Nevada's congressional delegation at the time was simply outgunned.
It was not a decision that flew in the face of the technical considerations at all. But it was certainly a decision that was motivated at least as much by political considerations.
And now the political tables have turned. Harry Reid is the Senate's majority leader, and the Yucca Mountain Project is, if not dead, at least moribund. Robert Fry says this leaves the nuclear waste issue, once again, in limbo.
Yucca Mountain at some point, or something that looks a lot like Yucca Mountain, has got to be done.
Fry says the whole scientific community has agreed for decades that eventually nuclear waste needs to go in a deep hole underground.
But it doesn't need to get done right away. And the future of nuclear power, the building of the next few plants, doesn't depend on Yucca Mountain being completed anytime soon.
And the Obama administration's decision is hardly a seismic event for the industry. Alex Flint is at the Nuclear Energy Institute, the industry's trade group.
Well, it means in many ways that the current state of play continues.
That means electricity customers will continue paying into a nuclear waste fund, which has already collected $22 billion. It also means that the U.S. government is not taking nuclear waste off the hands of the nuclear industry, as it promised to do. Instead, Flint says plants have found ways to store their own waste in pools of water and in dry concrete casks on the ground.
In many ways, we've reduced the urgency of a need to find some other solution to this material. We can definitely deal with this material for decades or hundreds of years. It would be ideal to come up with some eventual disposition proposal in this regard, but we have a lot of time to figure that out.
This is a philosophical shift from the early days of the nuclear industry. Then President Jimmy Carter assumed that we needed to solve the nuclear waste issue up front in order to put the industry on firm footing. These days, the industry is saying, now that we have solutions that will suffice for many decades, that's good enough. Anti-nuclear activists like Jim Riccio at Greenpeace aren't buying it.
There still is no solution to the problem we've created over 50 years ago. But digging a big hole in the ground and sweeping it under a rug wasn't an answer either.
The Energy Department plans to assemble a committee to review these issues this year. It has a big challenge as it attempts to deal with not only the question of nuclear waste, but global warming, too. Nuclear energy currently supplies 21% of the nation's electricity, and the plants do not produce carbon dioxide. So Robert Fry at Resources for the Future says the environmental arguments about nuclear power are shifting.
Well, I don't think we're in a position to disregard any of the options for dealing with global warming at this point.
And the debate over Yucca Mountain has, in his view, become a bit of a sideshow. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Well, I wish I'd been the one to record this sound, but I didn't get to go to Australia. Wildlife recordist David Stewart did. He went out one day and captured this sound of kookaburras for our series Sounds Wild. That's it. So thanks very much, Alison, for joining us on podcast this week.
Thank you. We'll be back with more germs and death next week, I'm sure.
Well, we'll do our best to gin it up. Listen, folks, we like having you out there, and we especially like hearing from you. So if you would write to us at nprscience@npr.org and tell us if you like the podcast. You can even tell us if you don't like it. Constructive criticism is our favorite. And join us next week because we'll have more. Thanks.
Bye.